A Connecticut state senator thinks that 30 to 35% of the inmates in prison in Connecticut have a diagnosed mental health issue. So the question we have is, what would have happened if they had received treatment at a young age? Welcome to The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. It's an intriguing question because when you think about how much it costs to keep someone in prison, what would the savings be, if any, if the state had simply spent some money earlier on mental health care? What would the savings be? Think about it from an economic standpoint. And not just that, what about reduced crime rates, better quality of life for everyone, more productivity, fewer number of police officers needed? And you can keep going on, at least in theory, right? We want to get your thoughts. Should the state open the wallet and spend the money for this? Is it worth it? Our email is tfs@wshu.org and look for us on Facebook at Full Story WSHU. Kathy Austin is a Connecticut state senator. She spent more than, I think, 20 years working for the Department of Corrections, and she joins us now on the phone. Hey, Senator, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for coming on the air with us.
Oh, anytime.
So you worked for the department, right, for more than what, 2 decades?
More than 2 decades, yes.
What did you do when you were there?
I was a correctional officer and I was a lieutenant.
Is that something you always aspired to do? I'm just trying to get a feel for your background.
Well, I was before that I was in the Army, and it was not a job that I necessarily aspired to, but it was a good, solid job that provided benefits and health care. And so I applied for it, and I was accepted in 1989.
Why did you switch over to become a legislator?
Well, you retire after 2 decades, and so I applied for this job through the voters, and I was accepted for that, too.
Now, when you worked in the prisons, did you see many inmates who you thought were dealing with a mental health issue?
Not when I first started, not in the late 80s, but as we finished closing the state hospital, we saw more and more inmates that came in that had chronic mental health issues.
I'm sorry, could you expand on that a little bit more? So when you first started in the 80s, you didn't think that many of the prisoners had mental health issues?
No, there were not as many as there are today.
And so then when the hospitals started to close, that percentage of the inmate population began to rise?
Correct. When the state hospitals for those with mental health issues started to close, the number of inmates that were diagnosed with chronic mental health issues started to rise. When we first closed the state hospitals, we as a state and across the country, there was a promise that was made that we would increase the amount of support services there would be, and that did not happen. There was no increase in support services for people to be successful when they were not institutionalized.
Let's fast forward a few years. Let's come to 2019. What do you think is going to be happening in 2020? And with that in mind, what percentage of the prison population do you think has a mental health issue now?
I believe that if you look at the numbers, they'll be between 30 and 40% of the inmate population is diagnosed with a chronic mental health issue.
Can you flesh that out a little bit for me? What types of issues?
Well, they may have schizophrenia. They may have bipolar. They maybe have a depressive condition. Any one of the number of diagnoses that someone could have as with a mental health issue.
Do you think this is pretty well known at this point? Because there haven't been a number of news articles about this, but is this well known for those who work in corrections or criminal justice?
It's certainly well known by those that work within the Department of Correction, whether they're a custody staff or a support staff member. And it's certainly well known amongst groups that that try to support people with mental health issues in the communities. They certainly see that there is a net increase of people that cross over into the criminal justice system.
If you're in prison now and you have a mental health issue, how is that dealt with?
It depends on which facility you're at. There are facilities that have more services. You might be placed on medication. You might be able to participate in groups. You might be able to see a social worker or a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but there's of those three job classes, there's not that many within the confines of the staff that work in the Department of Corrections.
Senator, when you say that you may go on medications, I'm assuming you would go on those medications voluntarily?
Yes, it can only be voluntary in the Department of Correction.
Okay, so the prisoner then would then be saying, I would like some assistance, or they would be told, you know, this program is available to you. Would you like to avail yourself of this opportunity?
If that program is not already, one, if the program is staffed, and two, if there are enough seats within that program, then you would be given the opportunity to participate in that, yes.
Are there enough psychiatrists? Are there enough seats? Is there enough money to do what you think should be done?
So there is not enough. There are not enough staff that have the qualifications to work with people within the confines of the Department of Correction. That is not necessarily what the best use of our prison system is. And is there enough money being spent within that? Not on this issue. We need to really get down into the details, figure out the exact number of people that we have there. More importantly, besides what we need to do to take care of people, often they don't qualify. People with mental health issues don't qualify to go into a group home or some post-incarceration program because they're not chosen to go into those programs because they're a more expensive person. They require more care. They do require different kinds and more expensive medications. The fact is that they often serve their whole term where someone else may not. And when they get out of the Department of Correction and their post-incarceration, without the support services, I believe that they recidivize at a greater rate.
Senator, you know that there are some who are listening who are thinking prisons are there for punishment. It's not there to take taxpayer dollars and engage in all these reform efforts. How would you respond to someone who thinks that?
Well, I think they're right. That's not what prisons are designed for. Unfortunately, there are not enough beds in support services to assist people who have mental health issues. And when they interface with the criminal justice system, judges and prosecutors are left with little options. And so for the safety of that particular person, they incarcerate them. Sometimes to stabilize that person, they incarcerate them. No, there is not. We need to do more work revolving around this issue and making sure that people are given the correct support so that they can be a successful person outside of incarceration, which is a much more expensive way to take care of somebody. So you can either look at it as an appropriate way to in a moral way to take care of somebody by providing the correct support, prisons are far more expensive than supportive environments outside the prison system. And I think that's where our dollars would be better spent.
We have to take a break in a minute, but I have to ask, when you bring up this subject in the General Assembly, what's the reaction from fellow legislators?
I think people are starting to become more and more aware of this issue and starting to look at the moral way for us to handle this issue and considering putting the necessary resources into providing supportive services for people.
Now, you're asking the Sentencing Commission to take a number of steps. Can you tell us what you want them to do?
Sure. First, I want them to get the numbers of inmates that are already diagnosed as chronically mentally ill. And now that does not mean that we capture everybody that has a mental health concern, mainly because not everybody has been diagnosed. And not every inmate that gets incarcerated is evaluated by a psychiatrist. But these would be people that are already diagnosed as chronically mentally ill. Then I'm asking, how do they do their entire sentence? Or are they allowed a release into a group home or out on parole or probation at an earlier time than the full term of their sentence? And once they get out of, and once they are not incarcerated any longer, and they are out, are they able to get the services necessary to support them, or do they recidivize and at a greater rate and become reincarcerated? So those are the things that I would like to know first and foremost.
Senator, you tried bringing this up in the last legislative session, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
What happened?
It was just a busy session, and the committee chairman chose not to bring this particular issue up. So I tried a different tact and went to a different group of people to try to get the same data that I was looking for before.
Talk to us a little bit about substance abuse. What percentage of those do you think in prison nowadays have an issue with alcohol or drugs?
I think that that number is probably even larger than the number that would be diagnosed as chronically mentally ill. But I don't want to conflate the two issues because they are different. While someone may be dually diagnosed as having a substance abuse issue, not everybody that's chronically mentally ill has a substance abuse issue. Not everybody that has a substance abuse issue is has mental health issues. So I want to make sure that we're looking at the two things separately from each other.
I believe the numbers I saw the other day, that there are close to 13,000 people in prison in Connecticut. Is that pretty accurate?
I think that that's the current number.
Okay. So you're talking close to, what, 4,500 people or so in the prisons whom you think need some kind of mental health assistance nowadays?
I'm sorry, could you say that again, please?
So if your numbers are accurate, 30 to 40%, so that means around 4,000, 4,500 of those in prison
correct.
Right now need some kind of assistance. What kind of money would be needed to do this? And is there anything like this, any inclination? Because Connecticut is on such a tight budget nowadays. Is our funds available to do this?
Well, I believe that we could use the funds that we are using to incarcerate people that have chronic mental health issues with by having the support services so that they either don't get incarcerated to begin with or they don't recidivize would help offset those costs. So I think within the confines of the current budget, just a smarter policy that we could take care of people before they become incarcerated and make sure that they have the correct support so that they can lead as full and successful a life as they can.
So if I can
without ever becoming incarcerated.
Oh, okay. So basically you're saying take some of the money that's now spent on corrections and then put it toward mental health programs to help those who may need help with mental health issues before they even start to have problems?
Correct. Before they become incarcerated, yes.
Before they become incarcerated. Do you mind if I bring in a guest who's in the studio with me and he's been listening to what you're saying and he's nodding in agreement and I know he wants to join in the conversation? Randy Brarin is Director of Reentry Programs. Hey, Randy, how are you?
Good. Good, Ron. Thanks.
Thanks for coming in. Randy, meet the senator.
Hi, Senator. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks.
Randy, a quick background from you. Yep. First, tell us about reentry programs and then give us your background.
Sure. Real quickly, family reentry is a...
I'm going to move the mic a little bit closer to you. It's all right. You can just swing it over. There you go.
Family reentry is a nonprofit agency here in Bridgeport. Been around for about 35 or so years. Does work in prevention, intervention, and reentry, all for criminal justice-involved clients and their families. We have had contracts with the Department of Correction, Court Support Services Division, Department of Children and Families for many years. So that is our client base and our primary funding stream, although we have a lot of people who also donate money and foundations and philanthropic agencies that support us as well.
And your background?
So like the senator, I've done a stint with the Department of Correction. I did about 28 years, started in 1981 as a correction officer right up the road here at the Bridgeport Correctional Center, moved out to a position in the parole office in 1985, and then parole officers are employees of the Department of Correction. And so I was a parole officer from 85 for the rest of my career, moving up through the ranks in various administrative positions, and then retired in 2009 as the director of parole, working for Commissioner Teresa Lance.
And what do you think about what the senator has to say?
Well, I think she's right on target in a number of areas. The closing of the state hospitals in the 1980s had a profound effect on areas like homelessness and the kind of folks who wind up back in jail. And, you know, the prison system, as she said, was not designed to handle mental health cases to that extreme. Commissioner Lance always said that she was the primary mental health treatment provider in the state of Connecticut. Mm. And she was probably right. And it certainly shouldn't be that way.
That is exactly correct.
And I also think I'm sorry, Senator.
I'm just wondering if I could listen in on your conversation now because I have another call that I have to make.
Okay.
I apologize.
Sure. Okay, no problem. We enjoyed speaking with you and all your thoughts, and I hope you come back on with us real soon.
I would love to.
Thanks, Senator. Be well.
Thanks.
State Senator Kathy Austin.
Yeah. I also think she was correct in the assertion that if treatment was made available, not only earlier in an individual's life, that they would have been moved away from a criminal lifestyle or had come into police contact because of their mental illness. But even while in jail, for many people who are first diagnosed, the earliest treatment possible, solid diagnosis, and then moving them into a treatment program that can help reintegrate them. They can move out sooner than they are now, and those are cost savings that can offset the cost of the treatment that would then be to be provided for a long period of time.
Can I ask you, at what age do you think that the treatment should begin?
That I don't know. I am not a mental health professional. I'm a regular criminal justice guy. Mm-hmm. But I know plenty of people who could answer that question very well. And I think the short answer is it varies considerably. Some of the folks we deal with have had mental illness that they've struggled with from early in their lives. Others led fairly good lives, problem-free, and then certain symptoms would emerge later in life. And so I think the age would have to coincide with the onset of the illness and the obvious symptoms, which a lot of people see but don't see as mental illness, and then fail to either recognize it as such and find programs to intervene, or they don't have the resources for that. Or in some cases, they don't want to acknowledge it. It's difficult for some of the men we deal with to acknowledge that they're schizophrenics. They don't want that label. They don't want to say it's that. They have a number of other reasons for their problems.
Sure. You know, anyone who has ever had to cope with someone who has a severe mental health illness understands how difficult that is to get someone that they love into treatment because it's such a battle.
Yeah, absolutely. And it can be very expensive. If you don't have the resources for it, then you are limited to only those types of programs that would pay third-party reimbursement, such as Medicaid. And those are very often not intensive enough for long enough periods of time to really manage these things long-term. There's no simple cure for any of this. You don't go in for 30 days and come out all fine. These are often lifelong struggles that people have, and they need lifelong support.
I have to ask you before we bring in our next guest who's going to join in the conversation, what kind of support or backing do you think there is from the legislators for this? Because as you and I were talking before the program, and we both said the same line at the same time, it's the old Fram oil filter commercial, pay me now or pay me later. What you're basically asking taxpayers in the state to do is to give them money now to prevent problems that might be cropping up 15, 20 years down the line, and saying, look, we believe this is the right way to go.
Yeah, and I mean, I think data would support that. I mean, there's enormous social and economic cost to waiting for major crimes to occur. And there's also human cost on the side of the victims who might not have been victimized, but for earlier, better, stronger intervention. And the clients themselves, whose lives may have been improved substantially, had issues been addressed more thoroughly and comprehensively at the earliest possible age.
Randy Barron is with us. He is the director of reentry programs, and joining us for a few minutes on the line is Professor Crystal Hayes, who's an online clinical social work professor at Sacred Heart University. Professor Hayes, how are you?
Hi, good morning or good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for coming on and joining us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Have you been able to listen to any of the conversation?
I did. I was able to catch the tail end of the conversation, yes.
Did you hear what Senator Austin had to say? She believes that 30 to 40% of the population, the inmates in Connecticut, those in prison, have mental health issues. Is that what you're hearing nowadays from your research and from your studies?
Absolutely. I think that definitely aligns with what the research is saying. I also think that number is probably a lot higher than what we think it is, mainly because much of that data is self-reporting data. So the people who self-report that they've had a psychiatric diagnosis or disability prior to incarceration may report that information upon entry into the correctional system. So I think we need to think about that part of it, that some of this is self-reporting. And then also we need to think about the capacity of our correctional system to really assess, you know, this problem. How are people trained to assess the problem? What does triage look like? What are the sort of questions that people are responding to when they're admitted into the system?
I'm trying to phrase this in the proper way, and so it doesn't offend people. You know, there are some who, and I was just talking about this with Randy, there are some who are saying, look, because of the tight budgets nowadays, and where the money has to be spent in the state, and you know, how do you convince people to spend the money on something like this now, and the payoff may not show up for a number of years? Do you know where I'm trying to go here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I heard at the tail end of the conversation, which I completely agree with, we pay now, we pay later. This is not a problem that's going to go away quickly. We know prisons and jails are not therapeutic environments. We know from the research that incarcerating somebody with a severe psychiatric disability only exacerbates the problem. We know people are dying in prison as a result of it. And we also know that when they come home, they're not any better. For it. In fact, in many ways, they're worse, and so there's a revolving door. I used to work in community-based mental health for a number of years in the state of North Carolina, for example, back in 2006. And so we know that at around 2007, 2008, we started to experience a recession, and so budgets were being cut, and the state legislature was making all kinds of difficult decisions about how to spend state funds. And one of the things that did get cut was funding for mental health. And so it was already difficult for people to access that care prior to that, but it became extremely difficult for people to access that care after those budget cuts. And so we did start to see, you know, some of the, you know, suffering go up. We did see an increase in, you know, people decompensating. And so I think we need to sort of just make some of those hard, you know, decisions around whether or not we want to pay for this stuff now or we pay for it later. And quite frankly, it's really the humane thing to do. At the end of the day, you know, people are hurting, people are suffering. And I think for the most part, folks want to do the humane thing.
Randy, it seems to be something that I think every government has struggled with for decades. They try to cut the budgets and they're penny wise, pound foolish.
True.
And but how do you convince the government officials to change those ways?
Well, I think it has to be on someone's radar, and it sounds like it's on Senator Austin's radar. The Sentencing Commission is an ideal place to vet this issue. The numbers are discoverable. We don't know exactly if 30 to 40% is the number, and even that is on a wide spectrum. Like other disorders, there will be some in that 30 to 40% who could function quite well. There may be others at the lower end of that spectrum that may be the 10% of the prison population who may be severely impaired and for whom long-term residential treatment followed by supportive housing with strong wraparound supports for the rest of their lives may be the only thing that keeps them out of cycling in and out of jail for the rest of their lives with the human cost and the victimization, et cetera, that goes along with it. So it's a lot of diagnosis and a lot of triaging. It's a lot of treatment plans that include a variety of resources, housing, medication, and good solid clinical and social service support to keep people in line.
Professor Hayes, at what age should the mental health support start to be provided?
Wow, that's an interesting question. So I think education around good mental health hygiene is important, and that can start extremely early. One of the things that I used to do when I did community-based mental health was go out into the community and have community education events just to talk about, you know, different symptoms. We would explore what does depression look like? What does anxiety look like? You know, if you find yourself having, you know, these set of symptoms, how might you access support? How might you understand those systems in relation to the context of your life? And so one of the reasons why we believe that that was important was because we wanted to sort of bridge the gap between community, the communities that we were working in and the community-based mental health services that we were interested in providing and offering to people. And so I think one of the things that that kind of education can do is break down those barriers and the stigma behind reaching out for help, asking for help. You know, no one would, you know, suggest that it is inappropriate to go to the doctor if you have cancer or if you have high blood pressure or diabetes. But if you tell someone that you just don't feel well and you're not quite sure why, that it's in your head, you know, there's a stigma to that. And so I think the sooner we can start that conversation with families and communities, I think the better for everybody. But then also we need to think about, well, then where are the supports going to really come from? How do we bridge those relationships between organizations and agencies and groups that provide that care with the community itself who, you know, may need those services?
We have a number of great guests for the remainder of this program. Professor Crystal Hayes is joining us on the line. Sacred Heart University. Randy Brarin is with me in the studio, Director of Reentry Programs. And we're going to bring in Abby Anderson now. Abby is the Executive Director of the Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance. Hi, Abby. How are you?
Hi. Great to be here.
Thanks for coming on. We appreciate your time. Were you able to hear what Senator Austin had to say a little bit earlier in the program?
Yeah, I've been listening in for the past, you know, 15 or 20 minutes.
What's your reaction to what Senator Austin has to say? And just to recap for those who may be joining us a little bit later in the program, the senator is saying that currently she believes that 30 to 40% of the inmates in the Connecticut prison population are suffering with some type of mental health issue. And she is basically saying, we need to treat this. We need to help these people. It would be good for society. Let's get Connecticut behind this. And Abby, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with her more in terms of why are these people incarcerated in the first place and why are we choosing a really expensive way to deal with people's you know, physical and mental health needs and criminalizing those behaviors. So to be clear, in Connecticut, we do have two different systems, right? We have a system for young people, and we have the adult system. We do in Connecticut have kids under the age of 18 who are in adult prison, and that's a huge concern of ours. And their mental health is obviously very, very compromised, being young people in adult prison. Now, that doesn't mean that we think the people who run that adult prison mean those children any harm, but it's almost impossible. In fact, we would say it is impossible to provide appropriate care for 15, 16, 17-year-olds in an adult facility. So I think when we look at this issue, a lot of the problem is that we are criminalizing behaviors that aren't actually criminal. You know, it's the same conversation we're having now about drug abuse and addiction. And especially when we look at young people, and, you know, I've heard you continue to ask, you know, at what age should we start to treat people? We need to treat people when their symptoms start to arise. And unfortunately, we cannot talk about juvenile or criminal justice in our country or in our state without talking about race and the racial disparity, right? Those kids of color, black and brown kids, are much less likely to get mental health care. They're much less likely to have access, either in their community or because of financial concerns. And they're much more likely to be criminalized, either through the school-to-prison pipeline and those push-out issues, or in their communities. So it becomes this vicious cycle of, instead of black or brown kids who have needs or are starting to act out, you know, maybe there's a divorce in the home or those kinds of things, instead of that being seen as, hey, what's going on? How can we help? It's seen as, what's the matter with you? You know, why are you acting this way? And then those kids get caught up in the system, and it's a vicious cycle that really never ends. And that's what Senator Austin is talking about as well, is the revolving door.
Randy, I'm going to ask for your reactions to what Abby had to say, and then Professor, I'm going to bring you in also, Randy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. At the early onset of symptoms is when some type of treatment intervention has to occur. The adult criminal justice system is not the place to handle that. And the juvenile system, I'm not that familiar with, but I can only imagine that the needs at the juvenile justice system are even greater than they are in the adult system.
Professor, I'm going to ask you to hold on for just one second, because we got an interesting email, and I'd like to read it, and then I'd love to get your perspective on it. And this is from John in Guilford. John wrote, I lived for years in an inner city neighborhood that had many former prisoners who were mentally ill. Some lived in halfway houses and some with family or on their own, including some who were homeless. I saw them on the street and at the soup kitchen where I volunteered. They were sometimes very nice people, friendly and polite, except when they weren't. And my impression was that they couldn't always control those shifts. It was painful to see someone who was normally personable have a bad day, perhaps to the point where the police got involved. I can't imagine that it would not be less expensive and less painful for all to treat these people sufficiently for them to stay out of trouble and lead satisfying, productive lives. According to the Office of Fiscal Analysis, the cost of incarceration in Connecticut is over $44,000 a year per inmate. Thank you, John from Guilford, for that wonderful email. Professor, what do you think?
Yeah, so I just want to echo what I heard earlier. I think it's really important for us to recognize the racial disparities in the system. We all know that there are huge racial disparities in the system. And to your emailer's point, you know, it's always really difficult for me when I have these kind of conversations, because I think what's really important about these debates is that we need to be thinking about them holistically. So for me, you know, when we talk about, you know, when do we need to start treating people with symptoms? How do we make mental health services accessible to communities? I also start thinking about, you know, things like, you know, well, what kind of communities are people living in the first place? Do they have access to, you know, fresh air? Can they go to a safe, clean park and play and exercise? Do they have, you know, safe, you know, places to go and buy healthy groceries? And, you know, do they have access to an educational system that is equitable? Are there jobs in the community? I mean, this is a holistic sort of human kind of problem. And it starts long before, by the time a person interacts with a police officer and by the time a person has, you know, is brought before a court, a judge in a courtroom, it is almost too late, right? So we've missed so many red flags long before that happens. And so what I would urge us to do is to be thinking about, you know, this more holistically, right? And we do know how to do mental health really well in this country. If we look at affluent communities, if we look at predominantly white affluent communities, we can see the kind of services that are available to families, you know, when there's some kind of psychiatric disability or crisis that happens. We see the kind of services that kids have access to in their schools. We don't see kids being shuttled off to the juvenile justice system who come from, you know, affluent white suburban communities. They get social workers. They get counselors. They get substance abuse, you know, counselors. And so I think we need to be thinking about it in those terms, too. Where are the resources long before someone interacts with a police officer?
Randy, I want to bring up something that you had touched on a little bit earlier. For some of us, I think that we can look at others and say, this person may have an issue, and I think this person needs some support, needs some therapy. But unfortunately, I know from life, many times if that person is a member of your family or someone close to you, that those family members are resistant to acknowledging or acting on what is obvious to others.
Sure.
So how do you get around that?
Yeah, well, you know, families are often the first ones to suffer. They're the first ones to suffer from the heartache of seeing a child or loved one go through what they're going through. They're also the first ones to be victimized if people have co-occurring mental health and substance abuse disorders. And they may be the first ones to start losing some property, things of that nature. And so it's difficult. And their love of an individual makes them less likely to kick them out of the house or to employ tough love strategies. And to actually acknowledge, just like we said earlier, it's difficult for clients themselves to accept the diagnosis. Mm. Some family members don't want to hear that either. But I want to echo what was just said as well in terms of earlier intervention. I was on a panel a few weeks ago of some New Haven folks who had a New Haven Young Leaders program. And it was the topic was the intersection of the criminal justice system and public health. And a big part of that discussion was about mental health and the missed opportunities in elementary schools. There were many parents there who spoke somewhat angrily that their kids in inner city schools that display all kinds of behavioral problems, who may have a lot of issues that some suburban kids may not have, and get no help in school, and they act out in school, and there's not a lot of people to talk to. There was a great couple of young police officers from the Yale Police Department who do community outreach, and they actually go into some of these schools and help. And everybody's very appreciative of that, and they do great work. There's no doubt.
Had those officers on a recent program, and they're amazing.
Yeah, but what they need are actual fully staffed social service offices in elementary schools. And all of that support can help identify problems and manage problems at an earlier point in their lives.
Mm. Abby Anderson, this goes back exactly to what you were talking about a little bit earlier.
Yeah, well, and also it echoes what the professor was talking about as well, because, you know, great for those two Yale police officers to go in and help in the New Haven schools. But it's unacceptable that we have police officers who are trained to be public safety. You know, they have guns. They have pepper spray. Why are they the ones in our schools talking to our young children about their mental health? That is, you know, that's no shade against those individual people. They're amazing people for doing that. But that is not the role of a police officer. And shame on all of us for being okay with that being our intervention for the kids who are absolutely most at need. And I really liked what Randy was just saying about the ballistic needs and what the professor was saying as well. We work with a group of justice advisors that 18 to 25-year-olds.
Abby, I have to interrupt you for 1 second because it's difficult to hear you right now. I don't know if you moved into another room or something, but your signal is dropping in and out.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Is this any better?
A little better. So maybe if you can move to someplace a little bit better, and that way
I'll try the kitchen.
Oh, okay.
Is it getting any better?
You know, just like every other party, it's always better in the kitchen, right?
<It's>... Exactly.
So you know what? Are you in the kitchen now?
We have our young adult colleagues with first or secondhand experience in the system. And they reached out over the past couple of years and do a lot of vision sessions with their peers and have these conversations about you know, how did we end up here? How did we end up in the system or system involved or with siblings in the system? And the things that they talk about were not the things that we talk about, right?
Abby, I'm going to hold you there because your signal, unfortunately, is still cutting out. So I'm going to tell you what. I'm going to ask you to move back into wherever you were before, and I'm going to go over to Randy and Professor Hayes while you get set back up. Professor Hayes, we have about 5 minutes left in the program, and I'm going to put you on the spot, and I promise you that I'll get you in here for a longer conversation in the future. If you have to do... three things. If the Connecticut legislature could do three things come February to help the issue, what should they do?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question?
Sure. So the legislators go back to work in February. And if they could do three things that you think would help the mental health issue, would help those in the inmate population in Connecticut, and would help society as a whole, what should they do right away?
Wow. So I think one of the first things that they should do is pass a bill that supports comprehensive mental health services in every public school in the state. I think one of the things that they also need to look at is the pay scale for social workers who provide mental health services. That's one of the biggest barriers to people doing the work. People are coming out of school with tons of student loan debt and are not making enough money to care for themselves and their own families. And I also think that they need to look at, criminal justice reform and talk to local advocates and activists who are on the ground, who are working directly in those communities, who have firsthand experience and knowledge about what is needed to help those communities thrive, and then, take their recommendations.
Abby, I hear we have you back. Abby Anderson, who's the executive director of the Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance. Abby, my question to the professor was, the legislature gets back to work come February. What would you like to see them do?
Yeah, I would love to actually echo what I just heard the professor say, right? The directly impacted folks are the ones that know what they need in their communities. And we have been working with some of those young people, our justice advisor colleagues, and their work on the ground is saying that kids and families are saying they need equitable housing, they need equitable education, they need economic opportunities, they need people to deal with the trauma that's in their communities. And the issues that we have, frankly, with trust between the communities that are most heavily policed, and then really trusting in the police and the courts to be fair to them, since they know that there are these racial disparities. So how do we heal those issues? I think a lot of times we get stuck on how are we going to provide better mental health services to people who are incarcerated, and we're really unfortunately dealing with the symptoms versus the actual root causes. And one of our big priorities this year, as we said, we have deep concerns about Connecticut really lagging behind in terms of incarcerating young people in the adult system. We're really out of step with the rest of the country on that now. So we're really hoping the legislature will move on that this year.
Randy Brarin, what would you like to see happen?
Well, a lot of my big issues have been covered. I think, honestly, I hate to keep saying it always boils down to money, but sometimes it does.
Mm-hmm.
And we definitely need attention at every point in the continuum, from the earliest intervention, and that means increasing funding for comprehensive social services in public schools, especially in high-risk communities. We need more dollars available for early intervention in the criminal justice system. Police departments that, such as New Haven, that have had a lot of their officers trained in crisis intervention so that they can de-escalate events rather than bring someone into the system. The court system needs more so that at the bail and pretrial stage, there are more options that can intervene and use the coercive power of the criminal law to help move people into treatment and help individuals and their families recognize the severity of the illness. Once in prison, the people in our program will come from one of two male psychiatric units, but they probably have a waiting list. My particular program's 15-bed residential, they could probably use one of those in every major city. Right now, we're the only one in the state. And then post-release, when sentences are over, some of these guys need long-term supportive housing with clean, safe housing with a supportive service network that is comprehensive and integrated into their housing program. These are all expensive items, but pay me now, pay me later.
Randy Barron, Director of Reentry Programs. Professor Crystal Hayes, online clinical social work professor at Sacred Heart University, and Abby Anderson, who is the executive director of the Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance. Abby, Professor Randy, thank you. It was a wonderful discussion. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Professor Abby, please come back soon. We'll get you back for a longer discussion.
Thank you. We'd love to.
Thank you both. And I also want to thank Kathy Austin, who is a state senator and also the deputy president pro tem. If you want to comment on today's program, please email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. On Facebook, you're going to find us at Full Story WSHU, and you can also leave a comment there. And all the Full Story broadcasts are available as podcasts. You can download the Full Story on Spotify, on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or Google Play. That's going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is the engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Fatou Sangari, Sabrina Garon, Roberto Rojas. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.